This is a CBC podcast.
Justin Trudeau made a little time for late night host Stephen Colbert on a trip to New York City for the United Nations General Assembly.
First question is, I like to, you know, cross my T's, dot my I's. What do I call you? What do people call the Prime Minister?
Really depends on them. I'm calling you Stephen, so you can call me Justin, I guess.
I don't think so.
Well, okay.
But even on American late night TV, the reality back home is unavoidable.
Heading into next year's election, your party has lost some seats in Parliament. Your party is 17 points behind in the polls. And this week, your rivals are calling a vote to possibly force you out of office.
Mm-hmm.
Force an election. Okay, yeah. So force an election.
I'm Catherine Cullen, and this week on The House, will the spate of confidence votes have any effect? And how a quip about a bathtub led to allegations of homophobia that prompted one MP to shout this.
But it had nothing to do with sex. I wasn't thinking about sex.
Our panel will tackle that. And the defense minister on Canada's plans to evacuate thousands, even tens of thousands of people from Lebanon. Plus, meet the Chinese dissidents who say they're being harassed by Beijing on Canadian campuses. Will a new law to combat foreign interference protect them? But we begin with confidence votes and how a diplomat's bathtub led to allegations of homophobia in Ottawa. The House is now in session. You'd think the chance to topple the government would be the most remarkable thing to happen this week. But between allegations of homophobia and a face-off between the Conservatives and CTV, the vote itself kind of faded away. Not that we're done yet. There are two more confidence votes expected on Tuesday alone. With me in studio to break all of this down are two of our favorite Hill watchers. Shannon Proudfoot is a feature writer for The Globe and Mail, and Paul Wells is a writer and podcaster. Thank you both for being here.
How are you doing?
Shannon, I'm going to start with you. Why are we seeing all these confidence motions at once?
It's an interesting question because, like, on paper, they're not actually going to succeed right now, right? Mm-hmm. At least this first one, we already knew the Bloc wasn't going to vote with them, neither was the NDP. It sort of seems to me to be a carpet bombing strategy, like just keep turning the screws, turn up the temperature. I note that the fundraising emails mentioned from the Conservatives mention these every time, and they probably are like catnip. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be more performance or symbolic than a serious attempt to tear down the government, which is not to say that the Conservatives do not desperately want to tear down the government at their earliest opportunity, because now would be just a dandy moment for them to wage an election. So it sort of seems to me to be operating on two levels, if that's not too mushy an opinion to hold.
It's also the Liberals trying to force some of this stuff out the door now while they know that these confidence motions aren't going to pass, because two of these are opposition day motions, and then right. We also have some of the actual business of government, right? Like the capital gains bill. But Paul, I want to ask you about what the Bloc is doing here. They came out this week, in essence, making demands for keeping the government afloat, right? More money for seniors, which we talked about on the program last week, and protection for supply management of dairy and poultry. What is the Bloc up to here?
Bloc is heading into an election where the Quebec numbers have been bouncing around a lot. And they're essentially in a three-way race. They are competitive with the Liberals, who have gotten a plurality of vote in Quebec in the last several elections. But they're surprised to find that they're getting the Conservatives nipping at their heels. So Yves-François Blanchet, the Bloc leader, needs to demonstrate the utility of the thing. Why would you want to have a Bloc Québécois there? And the answer is because you can bring stuff home. So he has put two specific demands on the table and given the Liberals essentially until the end of October to deliver them. And if they do, then he'll ask for other stuff. And if they don't, he will withdraw his support and start voting against the government on these motions. It's an interesting moment for the Bloc because they've come back from a near-death experience. I don't even remember the names of the last two leaders of the Bloc before Blanchet, because what they did was come pretty close to wiping the party out in representation in the House of Commons and certainly in sort of public relevance. They did pretty well in the last election. They've got 33 MPs, if I'm not mistaken. And now they're the only question mark in these confidence games. Everyone knows Poilievre wants an election. Everyone knows Singh doesn't. And so Blanchet gets to be dramatic and he sure likes that opportunity.
Speaking of dramatic, I also want to talk about a very heated exchange in the House of Commons on Wednesday. The Conservatives were going after the Prime Minister about the cost of a luxury condo for the Consul General in New York, notably about how the real estate listing mentions a handcrafted copper soaking tub. Conservative MP Garnet Jennis yells out what Hansard has recorded as, "Does he engage with them in the bathtub?" And someone else shouts out a comment about whether the Consul General got the top bunk. Then the Prime Minister stands up and says this.
Mr. Speaker, don't worry, on this side of the House, we're used to casual homophobic comments from the other side of the House.
That elicited a big reaction. The Prime Minister also suggested the Conservatives were bullies and said he was going to, quote, call them out on their crap. Here's what Jennis said the next day.
The point of that comment is to illustrate that, of course, meetings don't take place in a bathtub. A luxurious bathtub has nothing to do with meetings. The Prime Minister's answer had nothing to do with the questions, but it had nothing to do with sex. I wasn't thinking about sex at all.
Shannon, homophobia, defamation, as Jennis has suggested or claimed, or is this whole thing just ridiculous?
I just want to note that when you were teeing up the clips, I put my second headphone on and turned up my volume because personally, I watched this clip about 12 times with my colleagues like the Zapruder film, and we couldn't figure out what was actually said. All of which is to say, I think whether it was one of those things or the other really depends on exactly what was said in the intent. Because if you take Jennis at his word and you take the wording of the clip as something like, did you have those meetings in the bathtub? It's a perfectly germane response to Trudeau saying, look, we need this fancy residence because we're engaging with people about world issues. Okay, but do you need a handcrafted copper soaking tub to do it? If, however, the wording was ever so slightly different in a way that no one can hear on that tape, and apparently Speaker Greg Fergus couldn't hear either, then it's something much more adolescent, much more inappropriate. I would say, though, that like my kind of pox on all their houses upshot of all this is that the whole thing rests on kind of the most unfortunate tendencies of this parliament right now and these two parties, which is the Liberals will push that big red button of, you know, bigotry and self-righteousness and climbing on the moral high ground as fast as they possibly can. And the Conservatives tend toward meanness and adolescence. And also everyone is furious and just screeching at each other all the time.
Paul, you want to weigh in?
I don't see any reason to believe that Jennis is being homophobic in this case. The question was, why does this place need a fancy tub? Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister says, engaging with stakeholders, says, are you going to engage in the tub? I don't need to introduce sort of vile motives for that exchange to make sense. Sleeping in the top bunk, I don't know who that was, and that's a harder one to explain.
Exactly. Mm.
The thing is, these things become totems. I don't tweet, but I look at Twitter. And I see that the government's supporters have absolutely lined up like iron filings to take for granted that Garnet Jennis said this because he hates gay people. So it again, parsing it is almost not the question. As an election approaches, people are looking for any pretext they can to prove to the world that the other side doesn't deserve power.
I want to move on to another remarkable thing that happened this week. CTV parted ways with two of its journalists after a story aired on TV last weekend in which a Pierre Poilievre clip was altered and used out of context. That news item led to a standoff where the Conservatives were refusing to speak to CTV. And now, as we said, two members of the CTV team have left. Shannon, how big a deal was this mistake, if we want to call it that?
I really think it's journalistic malpractice. It's just to create a Franken quote like that. It honestly sort of makes my mind boggle in the sense that I don't even understand why you would do it.
And let's just bring people along here.
Sure.
What they did was take three phrases and sort of fuse them together. And because of the pictures that were cut over top of it, it sounded like Pierre Poilievre was saying this one phrase, which was actually sort of three different parts of things.
Right. But it was such an unelaborate sentence that they created. And there was another sentence intact. He was sort of saying, like, this is why we need a confidence vote. And they just sort of like slightly turned up the intensity of that. So the reason my mind boggles is like primarily because I just think this is indefensible as journalistic practice. The same way we wouldn't splice a bunch of photos together and put them on the front page and call them, you know, documentation of the news. This to me is the exact same thing. It's also baffling, though, because it didn't really accomplish anything that Poilievre wasn't already coherently on the record as saying. So it just seems like it's a massive, massive journalistic sin. Like there's no part of me that wants to excuse this or talk it down. But at the same time, I'm just sort of amazed by it because it accomplished nothing at a great cost.
Well, Paul, the Conservatives played hardball here, saying that they weren't going to speak to CTV until CTV apologized for its what they described as the Conservatives' malicious behavior. The Conservatives, in essence, won. What are the repercussions of that?
Conservatives will continue to argue, and I think in most cases believe, that not just the CBC, but all working journalists are out to get them because they are beholden to the Liberals for media subsidies and because culturally they just think more like Liberals. And so if management at CTV thought they were buying peace with this, I don't think they're going to be pleased with what happens next, which is going to be, you know, more similar treatment. One thing I learned is that CTV as an organization is not well regarded in conservative circles, hasn't been since the Nigel Wright, Mike Duffy, Stephen Harper's chief of staff wrote a check to get rid of an expense problem for a then sitting conservative senator. And every night for weeks and weeks, you'd turn on CTV National News and their then reporter, Bob Fife, was breaking new elements of the story. And there's been a bit of a grudge ever since then. That's a piece of...
I mean, that's
a
previous government. That goes back years.
It turns out offended people have long memories. That's a piece of sort of cultural lore that I needed to be briefed up on by a member of that conservative family. But I don't know who's really protected from the feeling that partisans have that news organizations are not sufficiently on side. These days, Bob Fife is making trouble for a Liberal government. I see again on Twitter that a lot of people think that Bob Fife should be locked up for continuing to do his job, even as government partisan stripe changes.
Shannon, I was really struck after this. A few conservatives tweeted that Pierre Poilievre is going to restore journalistic ethics and integrity. That was the lesson they took away from this. I wonder what you think of that.
I would love to know, like, this is a non-snotty question, like, what does that look like on the ground? Because as Paul's getting at, they have been turning their BB guns to everyone. Like, this is not, I take his point that they have long memories and wounded feelings about CTV from way back, but CBC's been in the same boat. Canadian Press, the words Canadian Press do not come out of Pierre Poilievre's mouth without him suggesting that they are Justin Trudeau's house pets, which we all know is ridiculous and egregious. It's only a matter of time, I'm sure, before my newspaper or Paul's Substack comes under fire for the same sort of thing. So this is not like a target-specific or a context-specific campaign that they're waging. And it bothers me because fast forward a year or so, when if everything stays the way it is, they are the government. Maybe they have a thumping majority. And then fast forward a year or two ahead of that, when inevitably dirty laundry starts to be put out on lines outside Parliament Hill, and they have built in an inoculation to suggest that any stories that come out that are critical of them, hard on them, that raise really hard to answer questions are somehow offside, greasy, do not have pure intentions. I really think, like, I hate to like push the bad for democracy button, but that does not seem like a good place to be. It pre-kneecaps any of your legitimate critics or legitimate questioners.
Yeah, I guess we do have to acknowledge, though, too, that incidents like what happened this week 100% is not the
not
media
help.
As if we were just one big thing, but the media help in itself either.
That's it. That's what's so kind of tragic is too strong, but that's what's so unfortunate about this is it gives credence to that idea. This was a really bad screw up that's indefensible. Doesn't help.
Okay, we are going to leave it there. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Journalists Paul Wells and Shannon Proudfoot. Coming up on the House podcast, they've spoken out against the Chinese regime. Now they say on-campus clubs in Canada are trying to intimidate them. How can Canada better protect free speech from foreign influence? Stay with us. I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to The House from CBC Radio, making politics make sense. A new episode drops every Saturday. The Middle East remains on the brink of a broader war, despite efforts by many countries and top diplomats to ease tensions. Canada was among a handful of countries to call for a 21-day ceasefire along the Lebanese and Israeli border. The Canadian government has been warning people for nearly a year to leave Lebanon that it cannot guarantee it will be able to help if war breaks out. But it's also spent the summer getting ready for a potential evacuation. There are approximately 40,000 people with Canadian connections still in Lebanon. So, what happens next. Bill Blair is the Minister of National Defense. We spoke to him on Friday. Minister, thank you for joining me.
Of course. Good morning, Catherine.
Can you confirm, Minister, reporting by Global News that Canadian troops have received a warning order to be ready to leave Canada within 48 hours?
Actually, I gave an order yesterday, and we're already deploying more police, more of our soldiers into the region. We already had soldiers deployed in the region, in Cyprus and in Lebanon. But I've increased that and ordered the deployment yesterday of 150 additional people into the region. And it's simply precautionary. At this point, we are concerned about the escalating situation in Lebanon and monitoring it very carefully. We have, you know, there are still commercial flights, Catherine, flying out of Beirut. 72 flights left in the last 48 hours. And so we have been trying to encourage Canadians in the region to take advantage of the flights that are available and to leave the region. Of course, that's the advice we've been giving now for several months.
What is the trigger for whether or not there will be a full-scale evacuation effort, whether or not you will deploy the full amount of Canadian troops that you have at the ready?
Well, and to be very clear, we're monitoring, along with our allies, a number of what we might consider indicators of escalating violence and where it would reach the point where it would be necessary. Our response will be scalable. You know, there may be situations where, you know, we just want to encourage people to get to commercial flights. And we can, if necessary, provide them with some assistance in order to do that. And at the same time, if the situation at the airport closes, for example, that would significantly change the situation that we would be dealing with. But we have been preparing for and even practicing a number of contingencies. You know, we've got, along with our allies, you know, resources in the area in order to facilitate a military-assisted departure. It'll be in a non-combat role, and you know, there are a number of scalable responses, including, you know, marine evacuation, because we have Global Affairs has done some great work in making sure that we have ships available to move people should that become necessary. And as I say, there's a number of responses that we are prepared for and have practiced. The situation, of course, will determine, you know, what is the appropriate response that we can offer. And there are some circumstances, Catherine, I think we need to be very clear with Canadians in the region. There are some circumstances where evacuation may not be possible if the hostilities range, you know, very significantly and further to the north. And so all of those things are being prepared and planned for.
There's a lot to unpack there, Minister. You talk about using ships, and we know that that's what Canada did in 2006 when it evacuated people. But your colleague, Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly, said that because Lebanon's port exploded in 2020, it complicates things. So to what extent are you hampered when it comes to trying to get people out by ship?
Well, Melanie's absolutely correct. The situation is complicated, and we know that there are less available port resources in Beirut. We are looking at other options, particularly in the northern part of the region. We are prepared to do whatever can be done to assist Canadians in the region. There are a lot of them there. Canada understands it. We have an obligation to provide assistance if they require it. We have been encouraging them to take the prudent steps of leaving the region as this conflict has escalated. We are deeply concerned. Right now, the situation has not yet reached a tipping point, but certainly there are strong indicators that both sides are engaged in escalating hostility, and we're concerned for the safety of Canadians in the region. We've given them the best advice possible, but we are preparing to do what is necessary and what may be required in order to provide them with the assistance they may need.
I do want to get to the bigger picture in a moment, Minister, but I just want to stay with the effort. Global News also reporting that Canada and Australia have rented a cruise ship. How would that fit into potential evacuation efforts?
We've been working actually with a number of our allies, but and certainly with the Australians. And actually for a number of months now, the Global Affairs has made an arrangement for a number of ways in which we can remove people, including the availability of a ship. It would enable us to move people out of the region, but there's a limit to how many we can move at any one time. We have worked with allies, including Australia, and you know, we are prepared. Should that be necessary, we'll be able to operationalize it fairly quickly.
Sorry, Minister. Our colleague Murray Brewster reported in June, in fact, to your point that you have been working on this for some time, that Canada was prepared to evacuate up to 20,000 people from the region. Is that still a scenario at this moment that feels like a realistic possibility, 20,000 people?
Well, and I think Global Affairs has already indicated that they believe that there are close to 40,000 people, Canadian passport holders and their families, in the region that we may have to assist in some way. That may not involve an evacuation, by the way. There's ways to get people to safety, but certainly up to 20,000 is the scenario that we have been preparing for.
You will remember, sir, I know you weren't in politics at the time, but in 2006, there was quite a bit of pushback from some members of the Canadian public when it came to this evacuation effort. In this case, you have been warning people, the government has been warning people for nearly a year to leave Lebanon. When the warnings have been frequent and repeated, why should the Canadian government help people get out?
Because there are people, Catherine. And very simply, just because people have made bad decisions with respect to their own personal safety, that does not relieve Canada from its responsibility to look after Canadians, wherever they may be in the world. And we believe that that's our responsibility. But at the same time, I also want to be clear, we learned a lot from the 2006 experience. It's one of the reasons that Global Affairs has been so assertive in issuing warnings and asking people to take the prudent course of action. And first of all, for Canadians not to travel to Lebanon to visit family and to vacation over the course of the summer, because we were really concerned about the increasing potential for violence in the region. And at the same time, we also know that there are lots of people in the region who are Canadians and who, for various reasons, have not been able or willing to leave their homes. But if the situation changes significantly, the violence has been primarily located in the south of Lebanon. There has been some incursions into the Beirut region, but overwhelmingly the violence has been in the south. People who are not implicated in that violence directly may not have felt that it was necessary for them at this time. But if the situation changes and they find themselves in jeopardy, Canada has a responsibility to Canadians wherever they are in the world, and we'll fulfill our responsibilities. But at the same time, you know, that we'll take them to a place of safety. That doesn't mean repatriation all the way back to Canada. It means get them to Cyprus. It means get them to other countries and safe havens in the region. And there's a cost associated to that as well. And for example, one of the things that Global Affairs has done quite recently is they've contracted with a commercial airline to enable Canadians in the region to fly out. But the Canadians in the region will pay for their ticket on the seat on the plane, and will get them to a place of safety.
Are you suggesting, Minister, that there people would be asked to pay a cost if you were evacuating them without commercial means, though?
Well, we will get them to safety. That's our responsibility. But as far as where they go from there and what they do when they get to that place of safety, that remains their responsibility. And as I say, I understand Canadians' concern, but I also understand Canadians' compassion. And you know, these are their fellow citizens anywhere in the world. If they need our help, Canada's going to be there to help them.
Okay. I do want to take a moment before we let you go, Minister, to ask you about the bigger picture here. French President Emmanuel Macron, the UN Secretary General, are among those raising the specter that Lebanon could become another Gaza. Do you share that fear?
We all urgently feel the need is to make sure that that does not happen. We are deeply concerned. And Canada, for months, and including many of our allies, including, of course, President Macron, are calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities, a ceasefire. And we also want a negotiated. It is essential that there be peace and stability in the region, and so we are still concerned about the hostilities taking place in Gaza and the loss of innocent life there. And we've called for a ceasefire. We've called for the return of all hostages, the laying down of arms, and the beginning of a negotiated resolution of the two-state solution. That can only happen when there's peace and stability, and we're deeply concerned about the escalating violence, and we're calling upon both sides to enter into a ceasefire.
And yet, there has not been an obvious embrace of that call for a ceasefire yet, Minister. So how would the international community respond if there was a ground invasion in southern Lebanon by Israel, as Israel has suggested?
And again, Catherine, you'll forgive me, I'm not going to get too far ahead of this. We're still working very hard on a diplomatic solution for peace. But we are preparing for what may be required of us, including, and I've already told you about the preparations Canada is taking in order to ensure the safety of its citizens in the region. All of our allies are doing the same thing, but I can assure you that there's a great deal of work going on in the background among our allies, speaking to both sides in this dispute and some of their closest partners, to make sure that we maintain peace in the region.
What is the biggest barrier right now, Minister? What is the biggest barrier to peace at this moment?
Well, I think, you know, both sides keep on firing at each other, and we need that to end. We need that to come to an end with a ceasefire, and frankly, it's very difficult to negotiate a peace when bullets and rockets are still being fired. We need the ceasefire in place, and we need it as quickly as possible so that both sides can get to the table. We're quite willing to support and assist in any way possible to maintain peace.
Thank you for your time today, Minister.
Thank you very much.
Bill Blair is Minister of National Defense. The public inquiry into foreign interference continues to unravel new allegations. But as the inquiry has heard over and over, Chinese government interference isn't restricted to politics. Canada's security agencies have warned that Beijing's reach extends onto Canadian university campuses. That can include threats, harassment, and intimidation for speaking out against the regime. Now, a handful of dissidents are telling CBC's Craig Dessen what they've experienced on Canadian campuses.
Rohui Yang is standing on a busy street in Washington, D.C., a little lost. He's looking for the entrance to a giant congressional building, but he's no tourist. It's June 4th, and this 24-year-old paralegal student from Toronto's Humber College is about to testify before a congressional commission marking the 35th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. As we walk up the street, he goes over what he's going to tell the U.S. Congress.
The first sentence in my speech is, 5 years ago, on the 30th anniversary of June 4th, I took the street for the first time, contributing myself into this movement.
Rohui was born in mainland China and grew up embracing the Communist Party ideals. His parents sent him to Canada for high school. Here, he started to learn things about China he'd never heard before. Things like the full truth of what happened at Tiananmen Square on June 4th, 1989. The massacre of students who protested the Chinese government.
So that's the part that really shocked me, and I started thinking, all right, this is it. This is the regime with no reason, absolutely preposterous, and we need to do something.
In 2019, he took to the streets of Toronto to protest the regime, but he was worried about reprisals from China if anyone recognized him, so he wore a disguise.
I was wearing wax, mask, even padding my jacket, just make me look really different.
But as time went on, he decided to take off the mask and go public. And in 2020, helped form the Assembly of Citizens, a Canada-based Chinese pro-democracy organization.
I do believe that it's my duty to support the future and democracy movement of my nation.
But there's been a price for stepping into the spotlight. Rohui says he's had death threats on social media and believes he's been reported to the Chinese consulate.
Even before I do this testimony, I do already receive lots of threatenings, lots of swearing words, insults on my different social media accounts.
The threats aren't just online. Rohui says one day the Chinese government made a surprise visit to his former in-laws.
I was married, and my parents-in-law was in the very south province in China. Some guy from National Security in my province, which is in Changchun in the northeast, fly across the entire China just to get my parents-in-law and want them to stop supporting me and sending me any monies.
What's worse, he says, is his own parents, who work for the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, have turned against him. Last year, when Rohui called to say Happy Mother's Day, he was stunned by the response.
Lots of swearing, really aggressive language. They was really, really, really furious about my activities conducting right now. They call me a traitor. They call me a slave.
Have like the authorities in China like visited your parents? Like, as if they're working for the party, this can't be a good look for them.
Yeah, like I think that could be one of the reasons they are being so against me. On the other hand, the Communist Party do harass them somehow. Like they want them to get some information from me, which they are really willing to do.
But you think your parents are trying to, in a way, spy on you?
Well, absolutely.
Today, Rajoy is undaunted by his parents' anger and strides towards the congressional hearing. It's being held across from the Capitol building. The hallway is packed with journalists, politicians, and staffers hurrying back and forth. Rajoy arrives at the committee room, where he's introduced to members of Congress.
Good morning, Andrea Salinas from Oregon. Thank you for being here.
Sitting next to him is another witness, a Columbia University student who's testifying anonymously. Her face is covered in a black mask, sunglasses, and a baseball cap, underlining the fact that not everyone here is willing to speak openly.
Mr. Yang.
Hello. Mr. and Madam.
We'll have you turn on your microphone, please.
It's Rajoy's turn to testify about what he's seen during demonstrations in Toronto.
Things that happened during the protests remind me that the national border cannot stop CCP from spreading fears overseas. Some Chinese, organized and encouraged by the consulate, drove their luxury cars through our processing line and shouting insults. They burned our flowers at the Statue of Democracy. Some protesters even received death threatening. My life was full of harassment of the strangers.
While just a handful of dissidents testified before the U.S. Congress this summer, many more activists in Canada described similar kinds of threats. Fred is another member of the Assembly of Citizens. That's his activist name. CBC is keeping his identity confidential because he fears Chinese government retaliation against his family back home. When he was in his teens, living in China, he signed a manifesto demanding more political freedoms in China. And he was taken into custody.
The cops just came to my school and asked, where is this guy? Where is this kid? We need to talk with him. Then I was being taken away. Then I was being interrogated by the police for 6 hours. And I remember the police had asked me that, did someone tell you to do this? I say, no, not at all.
His parents sent him away to Canada, to safety. They know firsthand the price you can pay for criticizing the Chinese state, because they themselves were part of the protests at Tiananmen Square.
I know that my parents have tried to stay on the Tiananmen Square until the last moment. And my mom had told me that she saw the armed vehicle with soldiers and trying to shoot the randomly shoot the people on the street. There are many students and ordinary citizens who were injured. And then one day the soldiers came to the hospital and arrest all the people with the gunshot wounds.
After the Tiananmen Square massacre, Fred's father was detained for months and then lost his job. His parents thought Fred would be free from repression here. But he says he's faced threats on social media for challenging China. We meet next in a park to talk more about the kinds of threats he's received. Fred describes multiple anonymous messages spamming his social media feed.
I have been bullied. I have been like spam bombed by those people who try to threaten my friend. Then say, I should go to die. I'm a traitor of the Chinese nation. I'm the traitor of the Han people.
Activists in other parts of Canada told similar stories. A recent Concordia University graduate who goes by the name of Zion believes his social media chat group was infiltrated by the Chinese police. CBC is also not using his real name because he fears reprisals from China for speaking out.
I started this chatting group and I welcome everybody to join in and discuss. There was this one time that I was contacted by one new member who asked about like where I live, what I think about the independence movement of Gunland, which is my hometown. And then, long story short, I did a little research with his number registering this account, and I find out this number also belongs to a local police officer back in my hometown.
Zion says he confronted the person in the group chat, who then deleted their account. I spoke to a half dozen Chinese dissidents here in Canada. They all talked about their fear of the Chinese government. And some pointed to a group found on campuses across the country called the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, or CSSA for short. As Canada's spy agency notes, CSSAs are not nefarious in and of themselves. They do provide a social and professional network for students. But Canada's National Security and Intelligence Committee of parliamentarians says that's not all they're up to. There's concern these groups may pose a threat to freedom of speech and assembly.
These associations were tasked with essentially helping students integrate into university in the West, but also keeping an eye on them.
This is Dennis Molinaro. He's a former national security analyst who now teaches intelligence history at the Ontario Tech University. He says the link between the People's Republic of China and these student associations is well known.
The State Department from the United States has said that the PRC missions, so that would be the consulates and embassies, actually fund CSSAs and direct the association chapters to basically monitor students, but also disrupt events or any kind of speaking out that are critical to the Communist Party. And the U.S. has said that this has continued to the present.
In a statement, Canada's spy agency CSIS confirms that universities are active targets of Beijing's foreign influence campaigns. CBC reached out to several CSSAs on Canadian campuses to discuss these allegations. None of them replied to our interview requests. But in 2019, McMaster University's Student Union took a stand against its CSSA after a lecture by a Uyghur activist on campus was disrupted.
During my speech, one of the Chinese students opened the door and then yelled at me in Chinese, "你说的全是垃圾," that means whatever you say is garbage. And he, bang, closed the door and left.
Rukia Tardush says she also felt uneasy about another man sitting in the conference room with his laptop open. So she started questioning him.
And then he said, "You're talking to me?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Mm-mm." And then I said, "Is your background is Chinese?" And he said, "Yes, I am Chinese." And I said, "Okay, so if you are Chinese, I have a question for you. What do you think about today's presentation?" And he was very angry at that time. He spoke in broken English and he yelled at me, "McMaster, you don't speak. You have no right. This is McMaster. You don't speak in McMaster." And I said, he just smiled, "Yes, I have. This is my speech freedom." And he stand up and he swear at me.
After the event, a group of Chinese student associations stated publicly they would inform the Chinese consulate in Toronto about Rukia's lecture. The McMaster Student Union then stripped the CSSA of its official club status for alleged links to the Chinese government. We asked the Chinese embassy about the allegations that CSSA groups are being used to advance Beijing's political objectives and that their government harasses students' families back home. In a statement, the embassy called the allegations, quote, "sheer smear and vilification." It said the CSSAs were established by the Chinese students who, quote, "love their motherland and take pride in being Chinese." They explain the Chinese embassy and consulates are obliged to provide them with appropriate consular protective services and finished by stating what the embassy did was above board and beyond reproach. And according to national security expert Dennis Molinaro, what's happening isn't necessarily illegal in Canada.
It depends what type of activity is being done. If it's some type of pressuring of students, Canada doesn't have a lot of laws in terms of foreign interference that are able to deal with these things.
But Molinaro says Canada's new law to counter foreign interference in Canada, Bill C-70, may make a difference.
Bill C-70 that recently was passed this past summer in June is hoping to address some of that with some clauses that can actually target people who are working on behalf of a foreign state. So we may finally actually have some legal options to deal with this type of activity. But on the whole, I would say most of it, no, is not illegal. And I mean, the main difficulty, I would say, outside of what you can do domestically, is how do you stop China from doing things like pressuring people's families or taking it out on someone's family because of what they do here. That's something that clearly Canada has very little ability to change or influence, at least on its own.
We still have the faith. We still have the trust. And we still have the courage.
Despite the online threats and worry about possible risk for their families back home, Fred and the other members of the Assembly of Citizens say they're determined to keep fighting for political reforms in China, from right here in Canada.
It's our duty. Many of people like our ages in China have been suffered, have been sacrificed. Even if we cannot see the democracy being flourishing on the land of China, we hope that at least we can plant the seed, and then we are waiting for the sprout and waiting for the flowers to flourish.
For The House, I'm Craig Dessen in Montreal.
So what, if anything, can be done to curb the Chinese government's attempts at interference on campuses here in Canada? Guy Saint-Jacques is Canada's former ambassador to China. Welcome back to The House.
Thank you for the invitation.
We just heard stories of Chinese students here in Canada who fear they're being targeted by their government back home for voicing dissent. Does anything you heard surprise you?
Nothing at all. In fact, I would add that there is a system that has been put in place since Xi Jinping came to power in 2012 under the umbrella of the United Front Work Department, which is charged with monitoring what is said among the Chinese diaspora abroad, but also they are in charge of monitoring students and making sure that everyone toes the party line. And I am aware of numerous cases where students have been intimidated. In fact, also, this is coordinated by the embassy, the Chinese consulates. They have informers on campuses. And what I've seen in the past is that usually if someone dares to express some critical comments on China, on Xi Jinping, usually within 24 hours is or her parents back in China will be notified. There will be a visit by the local police and they will tell them, speak to your child, because otherwise there will be problems that could happen to you. And usually, you know, that will be enough to scare the student and the person will stop making public comments. So it takes very courageous people to express their views. And all this to say that there is a systematic system in place that is very effective to try to shut down any critical comment towards China.
And why do you think it is, Mr. Saint-Jacques, that the Chinese government is so concerned about potential dissent amongst diaspora communities?
Well, you know, Xi Jinping is a worried leader. He knows that his policies have made many people unhappy, that many people don't agree with the direction he has taken China. China has now a much more aggressive foreign policy. The economic situation also is not very good. So, of course, the regime is concerned that people will start to express criticism and that this will spread and there will be a problem. So they want to keep everyone quiet. The other thing they are very effective at doing is to mobilize crowds when they need to. To give you an example, when Premier Li Keqiang came to visit Canada in September 2016, I accompanied the premier. This was towards the end of my posting as ambassador to China. And what struck me in Ottawa, in Montreal, was the large crowds that were there. Obviously, they had recruited students to be present at all venues. They were wearing identical T-shirt, holding banners to praise Li Keqiang. And I said to myself, well, you know, they have to be really well organized to mobilize all those people. And the students know they have no choice but to come to participate in these events. And because, you know, they know that otherwise they could be threatened by the members of the consulate or the embassy. If they receive scholarships from the Chinese government, they could be threatened that these scholarships will be cut, they will be canceled. If they need their passport renewed, they will be told, well, you have been critical, you won't get your passport renewed. And also they tell people, if you dare to criticize the regime, you won't find a job when you return to China. So for all those reasons, it's very difficult for anyone to criticize the regime.
And yet, the Chinese embassy, Chinese officials have constantly rejected any of these accusations. So I wonder, I mean, you were ambassador to China. How do you bring up issues like this with Chinese officials in hopes of making some headway?
Yeah. Well, of course, I would link this to the extent of Chinese interference in all aspects of Canadian life. And, you know, the Chinese are very good at a double discourse, because of course they can say that it's normal for them to provide consular services. We also do the same thing for Canadian students abroad. You know, if they need consular assistance, we will provide it. If they need their passport renewed, we will help them. If they are in difficulty, you know, we will help them. But there is a difference between helping and providing what I would call normal consular services and threatening people. In the case of China, people from the public security are everywhere, are very active, and their goal is to harass and to intimidate everyone. And so I recall having discussions with Chinese officials, because this would also apply to Canadians of Chinese origin visiting China. Sometimes they were subject to pressure. You know, they were told that they needed to be good patriots and help the motherland and bring technology and investment. And I would tell them, look, these people are no longer Chinese. They may look Chinese, but they are Canadians, and they have to be treated as Canadians. But, you know, the Chinese reject this. You know, for them, a Chinese is a Chinese. I recall also discussing with Ambassador Chong Piu, the previous Chinese ambassador to Canada, and I told him, I gave him many examples of what they were doing. For instance, I was aware that there had been demarches made by the Chinese consulate in Montreal, telling Concordia University to cancel presentation on the situation in Xinjiang, because they threatened them. They said, if the event goes ahead, we will tell Chinese students to go elsewhere. And of course, there are lots of Chinese students at Concordia. They even phoned the city of Montreal, their international affairs bureau, to tell them, put pressure on Concordia. And they were told to basically to go to hell, that Canada was a country with freedom of expression. But in fact, I think, you know, we are at the stage where we have to see what can be done. And I would say, you know, we have to pay more attention, especially to the Canadians of Chinese origin, and tell them that if they are a victim of intimidation, harassment, they should report this, and that the police will follow up.
I do want to talk about the tools that the Canadian government has put forward to try to deal with this. Parliament fast-tracked Bill C-70, the new law to counter foreign interference, which establishes a foreign influence transparency registry. Will those new powers do anything to stop the Chinese government from trying to silence activists here?
I'm not sure. I think the... And I have heard some people saying, you know, this will lead to racism against Canadians of Chinese origin. And I say to that, the registry applies more to people like me, you know, former high-level officials, you know, deputy ministers, ministers, who know how the government works. And if once you have left government, if you want to do business with a Chinese state enterprise or a Chinese government agency, well, you should register, you should say for whom you are working, and you should say how much you are paid, because you can provide very useful guidance to these companies, because you know how the government works. But in terms of harassment among Chinese communities, you know, I'm still struggling with what else we could do to try to prevent this, because, you know, a lot of the listening and the surveillance that applies to Chinese social media is done from China. And so it's difficult to see. I think at the minimum, the Canadian government should regularly go out and explain that Canada is a free country, that if people are victim of threat, the angle maybe to go is that if someone is threatened on Canadian soil, then there could be accusations. And if we can identify specific people at consulates or at the Chinese embassy, then we could intervene and kick these people out. But we will have to be more rigorous, more systematic in our approach.
Mr. Saint-Jacques, really appreciate you taking the time to give us your insights and expertise here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Guy Saint-Jacques is Canada's former ambassador to China. All right, that's it for us this week. Our crew on the house is Kristen Everson, Nick Murray, Benjamin Lopez-Steven, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. Thanks also to Miguel Plant for his work this week. I am Catherine Cullen. Thank you so much for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.